He was the rebel the world couldn't tame, the prophet they couldn't package, the man who sang not for charts, but for change. This is not the Bob Marley story. This is the other voice, the one they tried to silence. From the hills of Westmoreland to the halls of revolution, from bullets to prophecy, Peter Tosh never bowed. He burned. This is his truth. Uncut, unapologetic, undeniable. This is Peter Tosh, voice of the fire, the untold story. Welcome to the History of the Caribbean's audiobook. If you haven't already, please consider following us on your favorite podcast platform. Today we present to you Peter Tosh, A Journey Through Time, Episode 1. Let's dive into this thrilling narrative together. Chapter 1, The Bush Baby of Westmoreland. In the far reaches of Jamaica's western hills, cradled between cane fields and whispering banana groves, a child was born beneath the rustling heart of the island's untouched earth. The year was 1944, and the world was still clawing through the chaos of war. But in Grange Hill, Westmoreland, the only war that mattered was the daily survival of the poor. It was there, beneath zinc roofs and mango trees, that Winston Hubert McIntosh, the world would one day know him as Peter Tosh, opened his eyes to a world of contradictions. Beauty and brutality, rhythm and silence, God and the devil. He didn't come into the world with privilege. No silver spoons. No photographs in frames. No lullabies. Just the hum of insects, the faraway bark of mongrel dogs, and the occasional bang of a storm on the roof. His mother, Alvera Koch, was barely a girl herself, only in her teens, when she gave birth to Winston. His father, James McIntosh, was mostly a rumor, a ghost who drifted in and out of town like the wind. His presence was so faint that the boy came to understand early on that he'd be raising himself in many ways. Raised by his maternal aunt, he grew up calling her Mama, though he would always carry the sting of being an unclaimed son. From the start, Peter was different, not just in the way he stared at the world, but in the way the world seemed to move around him, like it knew it had birthed someone bound to shake it. He didn't cry much, but when he did, it wasn't the whimper of a typical child. It was fierce and haunting, like a note waiting to find its harmony. And when he was quiet, there was a gaze in his eyes that seemed older than the hills, like he had already seen more than most men would in a lifetime. The old women in the village used to whisper about it. "Dat little boy, him ah come wid summit ing. Him spirit heavy like prophet." The hills of Westmoreland were alive in those days, alive with sound and stories, with ancestral echoes buried in the soil. The mornings smelled like roasted yam and wood smoke, and the nights danced with the pulse of crickets and frogs. There were no streetlights, no televisions, no distractions. Just nature and the raw pulse of life. It was here Peter learned to listen, to truly listen, to the language of wind, the drumbeat of rainfall, the warning in a dog's growl, the silence before thunder. His ears were his first instrument. Before he could read or write, he could mimic birdsong and hum in perfect pitch with the gospel tunes drifting out of the chapel down the road. He grew up among the barefoot children who roamed the bush, climbing breadfruit trees and racing to the river with slingshots in their back pockets. They were wild and free, but not careless. Poverty taught them how to survive, how to move with the land. And Peter, always taller than the other boys, seemed to lead them naturally, not by force, but by presence. He was lean and watchful, with long limbs and longer silences. He had no tolerance for cruelty. When older boys teased animals or picked on someone weaker, Peter would step in, not with fists, but with words that struck just as hard. From a young age, he had a voice that could cut, command, and calm, depending on what was needed. Music entered his life not as entertainment, but as necessity. It was everywhere, in the rhythms of work, the chants of prayer meetings, the sorrow of funerals. On Sundays, his aunt would drag him to the Church of God, where women in white dresses wailed and flailed in the Holy Ghost, and the pastor's words boomed like thunder. Peter watched it all with skeptical fascination. Even then, he was wrestling with God, not out of disbelief, but out of demand. If God was real, Peter needed him to show up. He needed him to explain the hunger, the fatherlessness, the chains that still bound black men decades after emancipation. One day, someone in the village brought home a battered radio, and everything changed. Through that crackling speaker came American blues, country ballads, and the sweet slide of rhythm and blues. It was the first time Peter heard guitar licks and soulful voices that made his chest ache. And from that moment on, he knew he had to play. He didn't wait for a teacher. He made his own guitar from a sardine tin, fishing line, and a piece of wood. With calloused fingers and relentless curiosity, he taught himself every note. By ear. By instinct. By obsession. By the time he was a teenager, he had outgrown Grange Hill, not in body but in purpose. His thoughts were too big for the village. His questions too sharp. And so, like many young Jamaicans chasing something beyond the cane fields, he made his way to Kingston, a city bloated with hope and despair, promise and poverty. The move would shape him, hurt him, inspire him. But the bush never left his bones. Even in the concrete jungle, Peter carried the hills inside him. The silence, the rhythm, the righteousness. What the world would one day call militancy was really just clarity. From the beginning, Peter saw through the illusion. He knew Babylon didn't end with slavery, it just changed clothes. And he decided, even as a child, that he would never bow to it. His words would be fire. His music would be sword. And his spirit, his indomitable, unyielding spirit, would be carved from the bush, baptized by the struggle, and anointed by truth. This was no ordinary Jamaican boy. This was a seed the earth had waited centuries to sprout. And it had only just begun to grow. Chapter 2, Kingston's Harsh Classroom. The move from Grange Hill to Kingston was less a decision than a gravitational pull. Something deep inside Peter had started to itch, an awareness that the dirt roads of the countryside, though sacred, could no longer contain the size of the mission forming in his soul. The cane fields had taught him how to survive, but the city? The city would teach him how to fight. And fight he would against poverty, invisibility, hypocrisy, and Babylon itself. But first, Kingston would humble him, strip him, shape him. When he arrived in the capital, Peter was just a lanky teen with nothing but the fire in his eyes and a guitar he barely knew how to carry. The city was a snarling animal, noisy, impatient, unkind. A tangle of zinc shacks, chaos, and choking dust, where shouts and sirens replaced bird calls and crickets. He stayed in Trench Town, a name that would later become mythic in reggae's story, but in that moment, it was a slum. A place where the forgotten huddled in corners, and the air itself seemed heavy with despair. Men staggered from rum bars, women hawked fruits and dreams from roadside stalls, and children, so many children, ran barefoot through alleyways laced with danger. For most, Trench Town was a dead end. But for Peter, it was a forge. A crucible. The place where he would meet his brothers in sound, Bob Marley and Bunny Wailer, and begin a transformation none of them could have foreseen. But first, there was the music. Always the music. In Kingston, Peter became obsessed. Not with fame, but with mastery. With truth. He spent days at the back of music shops, just listening, studying the licks of Curtis Mayfield, the croon of Sam Cooke, the rebellion of Ray Charles. He watched people. Not just performers, but preachers, hustlers, madmen, prophets. He learned their rhythms, their lies, their poetry. And every night, he would return to whatever corner he called home and practice until his fingers bled. He built his sound not from sheet music, but from necessity. It was in these streets that he first encountered the razor's edge of Babylon. The word that would become central to his message was not just a Rasta term. It was lived experience. Babylon was the cop who beat the Rasta for walking barefoot. It was the landlord who kicked you out for having too many children. It was the politician who smiled in the ghetto and stole in the parliament. Peter saw it all and made a vow. He would never serve it. Never flatter it. Never sell his soul for comfort or coin. He wasn't yet famous, but people noticed him. He was tall, taller than most, with a body like a branch and eyes like coals. He didn't smile much, but when he did, it was sly, like he knew something the rest didn't. His presence was magnetic in a way that unsettled people. Even in silence, he radiated danger, not violence, but truth. And in a world built on deception, truth is a terrifying thing. It was during these formative years that Peter met Joe Higgs, the godfather of reggae, a man who didn't just sing but taught. Joe was running informal vocal lessons in a Trench Town yard, offering guidance to any youth with ears and discipline. Peter showed up not as a student, but as a question. Raw, fierce, and self-taught, he didn't seek validation, he wanted challenge. And Higgs gave it to him, pushed him, honed him, taught him breath control, harmony, arrangement. For the first time, Peter's natural gift was placed in a structure, not to limit him, but to elevate him. And it was here, in that very yard, that three voices first blended into one harmony. Peter, Bob, and Bunny. They were different in temperament. Bob was charismatic, a quiet strategist. Bunny was mystical, measured, and spiritual, and Peter was the sword, the uncompromising blade. But when they sang together, something happened that none of them could explain. It was alchemy. Their harmonies were tight, urgent, like prayers shouted into the wind. Their voices wrapped around each other like vines climbing a burning wall. They formed the Wailing Wailers, and the name wasn't just catchy, it was prophetic. They wailed. For justice. For bread. For Africa. For the end of white supremacy. For the dignity of the ghetto man. Peter was especially obsessed with lyrics. He insisted that every word mean something. No fluff. No filler. He didn't want to entertain. He wanted to educate. To awaken. Music, he would later say, is not just for enjoyment. It's a weapon. But long before they made their mark on the world, they faced rejection after rejection. Studios turned them away. Producers scoffed. The industry was wary of Rastas, and even warier of songs that challenged the system. They wanted love songs, not revolution. But Peter refused to bend. And slowly, painfully, the doors began to open. The first time Peter entered a recording studio, he was electric. There were knobs and wires and big men with bigger egos, but Peter didn't flinch. He didn't just play guitar, he owned it. His chord voicings were bold, unusual, forged from intuition and emotion. And when he sang, it was like a stone dropped into a still pond, heavy, rippling reel. As the Wailers gained traction, Peter also began to evolve philosophically. He wasn't just reading the Bible, he was dissecting it, questioning it, debating elders and scholars. He started quoting Marcus Garvey, invoking Haile Selassie, studying African liberation movements. He became increasingly radical, believing not just in spiritual salvation, but in systemic dismantling. He wore his dreadlocks not as a trend, but as a crown, as rebellion. But Kingston was watching, and not everyone liked what they saw. Peter was already becoming dangerous to the establishment. His mind was too sharp, his tongue too unfiltered. He spoke truth in places where silence was currency. He challenged the clergy, the police, even his own peers. He would walk into a room and change the air, sometimes with anger, sometimes with clarity, always with presence. Those early Kingston years were the University of Peter Tosh's revolution. He didn't earn a diploma. He earned scars. He learned what it meant to live on the edge, to be too Rasta for Babylon and too militant for comfort. But he never flinched. Not once. Every hardship only sharpened his message. Kingston was his classroom. Its people were his textbooks. And what he learned in those sweat-soaked streets would not only shape his music, it would define his very existence. Because while others learned how to survive in Babylon, Peter Tosh learned how to burn it down. Chapter 3, The Birth of the Wailers. In the humid, fractured heartbeat of Kingston's inner city, something miraculous was stirring. A tremor in the atmosphere, a silent tension gathering like thunder before the rain. The ghetto was no place for dreamers, but it had a strange way of forging legends. And it was here, amid zinc fences, political bloodstains, and marijuana smoke, that three young men crossed paths in a way that would alter the very sound of the world. Their names were Bob Marley, Bunny Livingston, and Winston Hubert McIntosh, Peter Tosh. Together, they would become the Wailers. Not a band, a movement. Their origin was no polished fable. There was no manager, no fame, no fancy rehearsal space. Only hunger, real, growling hunger, and a shared pain so deep it could only be screamed in harmony. They met through Joe Higgs, the wandering music sage of Trench Town. Higgs didn't teach music for money. He taught it to keep young men from falling into Babylon's trap. He would hold court in a dusty backyard, running harmony drills like a militant. And that's where they collided, three voices, three visions, one purpose. Bob was the dreamer, the tactician. He had an almost messianic calm, a quiet charisma that could still a room. Bunny was the mystic, deeply spiritual, steeped in Rastafari teachings, with a sense of rhythm and harmony that bordered on divine. And then there was Peter, the flame, the sword, the skeptic and warrior who refused to be tamed. He was already writing songs of revolution, even if no one was ready to listen. Together, they weren't just talented, they were anointed. Their first rehearsals were raw, almost brutal in discipline. Joe Higgs was relentless, drilling them on pitch, phrasing, timing. He made them harmonize until they could read each other's breath. And when they sang together, those three voices, it wasn't pretty in the conventional sense. It was urgent, a sound carved from the ghetto's grief, polished by sweat, and set on fire by defiance. Peter didn't just play guitar, he innovated. He refused to mimic American sounds. Instead, he reimagined the instrument. Using chord structures that felt primal and unpredictable, he brought in a heaviness that grounded Bob's higher melodies and gave Bunny's harmonies a place to rise. His baritone became the foundation of their sound, the soil beneath the roots reggae would one day grow from. The group was first called the Wailing Wailers, a name that spoke volumes. They wailed for the poor. They wailed for the voiceless. For the broken, the black, the forgotten. Every note was a scream in the face of Babylon. They weren't singing to entertain, they were singing to survive. Their first tracks were recorded at Studio One, Jamaica's legendary sonic crucible run by Clement Coxone Dodd. It was there, in a hot, cramped room with malfunctioning equipment and cigarette smoke curling toward the ceiling, that they laid down their first hit, Simmer Down. But that track was a compromise, a ska anthem made to move feet, not minds. And though it shot to the top of the local charts and gave the Wailers their first taste of success, Peter was already uneasy. He didn't want music that simply soothed. He wanted music that provoked. Even then, he felt the pull to push beyond what the radio wanted. He didn't want to simmer down. He wanted to set fire. As the Wailers began to gain notoriety, they lived the harsh duality of early fame. Their names were spreading through the island, but their pockets remained empty. They were exploited, underpaid, and pushed to perform for scraps while producers profited. Peter, in particular, bristled at the injustice. He read contracts like weapons manuals. He challenged producers, clashed with radio stations, and refused to be played for a fool. He knew the industry was another arm of Babylon, designed to use black voices while silencing black truths. Still, they pressed on. They rode buses to shows with guitars on their backs and hopes in their throats. They wore patched clothes, shared meals, and found shelter wherever kindness allowed. Every performance was a battle cry. Crowds would gather, not just because the music was good, but because it was real. When Peter sang, people didn't dance. They listened. They leaned in. They heard their own stories reflected back at them in a deeper, more dangerous way. It wasn't long before the trio began experimenting beyond ska, embracing a slower, heavier rhythm that pulsed like blood beneath skin. This was the birth of what the world would call roots reggae. It wasn't about the beat, it was about meaning. The Wailers began writing songs not for radio, but for revolution. Get up, stand up, for 100 years, stop that train. These weren't songs, they were sermons. And Peter's voice, always the sharpest, always the boldest, cut through the mix like thunder. But even as their sound matured, their unity was tested. Tensions grew. The trio were brothers, but not always aligned. Bob was increasingly seen as the face of the group, something that grated on Peter. Not because of ego, but because he feared the message was being diluted. Peter wanted no filters, no diplomacy. He wanted the raw truth. No compromise. No softening for mass consumption. And the world was not yet ready for a man like Peter Tosh. There were fights, philosophical, spiritual, musical. But beneath the friction was love, a sacred bond forged in struggle. Even when they argued, they understood what they were building was bigger than any one of them. Still, the industry pushed for Bob to go solo, to become the marketable frontman. Bob's path began to rise differently, gently supported by Chris Blackwell and Island Records. Peter saw it clearly. Bob would be the bridge. He would be the fire. And fire, as history has shown, is rarely rewarded in its time. Eventually, the group would splinter. Not in hate, but in divergence. Their missions were still aligned, but their methods diverged. Peter refused to follow the path of diplomacy. He wasn't interested in mainstream acceptance. He wanted to shout the truth until Babylon collapsed under the weight of it. But in those early years, before the fame, before the split, before the mythologies were written, there was something sacred between them. On a hot trench town afternoon, three young men, armed with nothing but harmony and hope, built a sonic weapon the world wasn't ready for. The Wailers weren't just a band. They were a prophecy, a warning, a call to arms wrapped in melody. And Peter Tosh? He was the one who sharpened the blade. Chapter 4, Simmer Down to Stand Up. At first, it was a triumph. Simmer Down had exploded like a firecracker across the island's airwaves. The Wailing Wailers, three scrappy ghetto youths with no shoes and no formal training, had a number one single. It played in taxis, on radios perched in shop windows, at corner dances where the sound systems roared into the Caribbean night. People sang along to its infectious refrain, its upbeat rhythm, its tightly braided harmonies. For a moment, they weren't just surviving, they were celebrated. But while the public danced, Peter Tosh stood still. He listened not to the melody, but to the meaning, or lack thereof. To him, "Simmer down," was a warning shouted in reverse. The song urged the rude boys to calm their violence, to quiet their rage, to simmer down. But what if that rage was righteous? What if the violence was born from hunger, injustice, systemic neglect? Peter knew the streets. He had walked beside the same rude boys who were now being told to soften their edge. And while he understood the call for peace, he couldn't ignore the feeling growing in his gut. Why should the oppressed be told to simmer down, while the oppressors turned up the heat? In that question lay the seed of everything he would become. While Bob embraced the success with gratitude and cautious optimism, and Bunny channeled his spiritual focus inward, Peter wrestled with something deeper, responsibility. He began to see the power of music not just as a career, but as a weapon. If a simple song like Simmer Down could sweep across Jamaica, then what could a song with true revolutionary fire do? What if, instead of calming the poor, they awakened them? Peter was never one to be satisfied with applause. Where others saw praise, he saw pressure. You have a platform now, so what will you do with it? That thought never left him. He started writing more, thinking harder. The chords grew heavier, the lyrics more confrontational. He dug deeper into Rastafari philosophy, into Garveyism, into Pan-Africanism. He read voraciously, books passed from hand to hand in the ghetto, texts banned by schools, but alive in the minds of rebels. It was around this time that Peter began to see the music industry itself as another face of Babylon. The same way plantation masters once worked slaves to build wealth, these producers and label men worked the poor man's voice, the poor man's rhythm, and fed it back to the masses with a glossy coat and a hollow core. He could feel it already, how they wanted the wailers to be digestible, to speak of love, not liberation, to entertain, not educate. And he refused. He started arguing more openly with studio executives. When they asked for another Simmer Down, Peter brought songs like For 100 Years and Downpresser Man. Songs that didn't ask the rude boy to be quiet, but asked the system why it never listened. Songs that pointed fingers, raised fists, bared teeth. Producers would flinch at his lyrics. "Tone it down," they'd say. "People want to feel good." But Peter didn't want people to feel good. He wanted them to wake up. During performances, the change became visible. Peter no longer simply harmonized, he testified. While Bob moved with spiritual rhythm and Bunny closed his eyes in trance-like flow, Peter's presence became more jagged, more urgent. He would stop mid-song to address the crowd, calling out politicians, priests, and police with the fearlessness of a man who had nothing to lose. Sometimes the crowd would cheer. Sometimes they would go silent. But they always listened. The deeper he fell into Rastafari, the more clarity he found. To Peter, it wasn't just a religion, it was a lens through which to understand the world. It was the connection to Africa, to Haile Selassie, to the truth that black people had been fed lies for centuries and were owed not just equality, but reparations. And as the Wailers grew more popular, Peter saw an opportunity, not to chase stardom, but to reshape the narrative. He began crafting music as a mirror, not to reflect what was, but to expose what was hidden. He began bringing Nyabingi drumming into his music, referencing biblical prophecy, naming names in his lyrics. While others were cautious about politics, Peter charged straight in. He openly criticized Jamaica's government, calling out Prime Minister Michael Manley and Edward Seaga alike. He challenged not only colonial legacies, but the complicity of the Jamaican elite in maintaining Babylon's structure. And with every word, he took a step further from safety. It wasn't long before people started to take notice. Not just fans, but the establishment. The police began harassing him more frequently. He was arrested for petty infractions, roughed up at checkpoints, tailed by plainclothes men. The system was watching him, and Peter knew it. But instead of backing down, he leaned in harder. "Me no fear no death," he once said. "Only the truth me fear fi betray." That level of defiance wasn't performative. It was personal. It was forged in Kingston's alleys, in the betrayal of corrupt producers, in the silence of the world while Africans starved and America bombed Vietnam. Even within the group, the divide widened. Bob, with his growing international appeal, began crafting songs that, while still powerful, were more metaphorical. "No Woman, No Cry," "Redemption Song," "Three Little Birds." Peter respected the messages, but he bristled at the packaging. To him, revolution shouldn't come in lullabies. It should shake walls, break chains. He wanted direct fire. And it became clear, Peter's path could not run parallel with compromise. The industry wanted Bob. He was palatable, photogenic, diplomatic. But Peter? Peter was dangerous. He wore his anger openly. He called white supremacy by its name. He refused to smile for cameras or sit with executives who didn't respect black sovereignty. Island Records, led by Chris Blackwell, saw where the wind was blowing and began pushing Bob as the singular face of the Wailers. It hurt, deeply, not because Peter wanted the spotlight, but because he saw how the fire was being tamed, how the revolution was being marketed. The internal friction became too heavy. Bunny, disillusioned with the business and its spiritual compromises, withdrew. Peter, unable to watch the message be watered down, made the painful choice to walk away. The Wailers, as a trio, were no more. And yet, Peter wasn't broken. He was reborn. His departure wasn't a retreat, it was a declaration. He would no longer try to fit into a system that was built to mute him. He would build his own path, his own sound, his own ministry of music, where the chords would be sharp, the lyrics unfiltered, and the goal singular. Burn Babylon to the ground with truth. The world hadn't seen anything yet. Peter Tosh wasn't here to simmer down. He was here to stand up.